This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
The inner workings of our pet's bodies, like its nervous system, can appear perplexing and frightening when it doesn't work properly. I like to demystify the body by thinking of it as a collection of commonplace items. The nervous system is like the body's internal computer. A combination of chemical and communication systems. Information about what is happening inside and outside of the body is detected. The information is transmitted to the main processor, the brain, via phone and electric lines, our nerves. Our ability to survive and thrive depends on these messages being sent in a well-ordered and consistent pattern. These processes can be disrupted by breaks in the lines, injuries, hacked by diseases such as viruses, bacteria, abnormal chemical reactions, or tumors. It's possible that the wire may never have been properly configured in the first place, congenital or inherited defects. My guest is an expert in unraveling diseases affecting the pet's neurological system, repairing the damage when possible, or controlling the signs when it's not. Dr. Ali Gorgi is a board-certified veterinary neurologist and neurosurgeon who owns Bright Care Veterinary Hospital in Orange County, California. We'll be right back after the short break.
Does your dog itch, scratch, stink, or shed like crazy? Come to Dynavite for help.
Order a 90-day supply of Dynavite.
Dynavite for life.
Pick up two tubes of Dogasuds.
Get the third tube free.
Peppermint, tea tree, lavender, Dogasud shampoo.
Made with all-natural coconut, jojoba, aloe. Great for healthy skin and soft, shiny coats.
But no itchy, harsh chemicals.
Lather up, rinse away.
Try Dogasuds. Buy two, get one free.
At Dynavite.com.
Dynovite.com.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Dr. Gorgi, thank you. This is a topic that I think is really important. So many people, whenever there's anything going on with their nervous system, get so, so nervous. Well, let's start off with dog and cat neurological systems. How similar is it to ours, a human being?
Well, that's a question that actually I get on a routine basis from my clients and pet owners, too. And fundamentally, the nervous system of most mammals, they have more similarities than differences. So dog and cat nervous system, which includes the brain, the spinal cord, and the peripheral nerves, along with some other, components to it, are, quite similar to our nervous system. Having said that, there are also some noticeable differences. And even amongst our patients, amongst different animals, even between dogs and cats, there are some differences between them too. And what that translates into is, because of that, the types and group of diseases that, each species get, although there are a lot of things in common, but also there could be a lot of differences between them. And one of the examples that we see it quite often clinically is, for example, in dogs, we see much more disease processes that arise from immune system. They're called autoimmune or immune-mediated diseases compared to cats or people, and the list goes on and on.
Fascinating, because there are times as I'm trying to explain things going, but for instance, strokes. People always want to know, do pets get strokes? And I used to say, not really. And I understand that now they're thinking that, yes, they do. Is that correct?
That is actually a very interesting question. And the short answer is yes. Even when I was in vet school, which at least I like to think it wasn't too long ago, but it's getting quite up there, I remember vividly one of my classes in pathology, I was told that dogs do not get stroke.
Ah, good. So I was awake when they said that. All right.
Exactly. And I was awake too. And initially a lot of times we thought that, you know, dogs and cats, they don't get stroke or it's extremely rare in them. And what really allowed us to identify this a lot more is with the advancement of imaging, which is, MRI being readily available in veterinary medicine. And after we started imaging, you know, these patients, we realized that strokes do happen a lot more, you know, often than we thought. Still, compared to people, strokes are less common in dogs and in cats, but we see them clinically all the time. And, you know, when we talk about stroke, the types of strokes that, you know, our patients get compared to people could also be a little bit different. You know, for example, in dogs and cats, more often we get ischemic strokes or ischemic infarctions of their brain. In people, you know, aneurysms happen quite commonly, which are, you know, rare in cats. So sometimes it's comparing apples and oranges, the types of strokes, but still strokes happen, you know, commonly, and we see them on clinical basis, you know, all the time in pets.
If you could be so kind as to define what is a stroke, you mentioned ischemic and aneurysms, and these may be terms that my listeners aren't familiar with.
So yeah, so stroke is, you know, basically a common term for some sort of vascular accident, you know, some sort of, you know, disturbance in the blood supply, you know, to the brain or to the nervous system, but, you know, for the most part, the brain. And, you know, the difference in that is when we say ischemic stroke, it means lack of blood supply to that part of the brain. So for various reasons, you know, it may be an embolus, maybe a thrombus, something causing a disturbance of blood supply to that part of the brain. And that is the type of stroke that we see more commonly in our patients, you know. The other type of stroke is an aneurysm, which that's, you know, bleeding into the brain or into the nervous system, and they could have various causes going on, and that is the type of, you know, stroke that does happen in our patients, but it's much, much less common, and it's much more common in human patients or primates.
What are some of the most common neurological diseases that are affecting the pets that you're seeing?
So neurological diseases are a little bit interesting and different than some of the other conditions. And because, you know, sometimes it sounds like real estate, but it's all about location. You know, the location of the problem dictates the clinical signs that, you know, either us as a clinician or the clients could see and the pet is suffering from. So obviously, based on the underlying cause, the onset of the disease, the progression of it, and the outcome could be quite different, but the symptoms are going to be very similar. So I will put them in categories of clinical signs, you know, which is easily recognizable to a pet owner or to the client, and they would include paralysis. You know, that's one of the more common conditions that we see, and it could be hind end paralysis or it could be paralysis of, you know, all four limbs. Another thing which is kind of close by but a little different is weak and wobbly gait, or as we call paresis and ataxia. Again, just a, you know, fancier term for weakness and wobbliness. Another common group of diseases or symptoms that I do see is severe or ongoing pain that is not responsive to, you know, regular management, you know, cases that they do have back pain, neck pain, or sometimes really initially to the client, it's unknown where the pain is originating from. And, you know, obviously when you have a painful patient, the first person to go is your, you know, family veterinarian. But sometimes when the pain does not respond normally or, you know, as expected to treatment and becomes a chronic pain or a very severe pain, that those are cases that often present to us for further diagnostics and care. And the other two conditions that we see quite frequently are seizures. Seizures are, you know, a very wide group of conditions. They could have very different underlying causes and different outcomes. But at the end of the time, a seizure is just an abnormal electrical activity in their brain that manifests itself in many different forms. But the most common type of seizures that, you know, at least we recognize and a pet owner recognizes is the so-called grand mal or generalized seizure, when the patient has convulsions and the body goes through that process, although seizures could present in many different ways. And it's one of the very, you know, devastating conditions for a pet owner and for the pet alike. And the other, you know, since we're going to talk about five, you know, most common conditions, the fifth one would be vestibular disease. And, you know, similar to vertigo event in a person, oftentimes it could be a very severe vertigo event. And again, like seizures, vestibular disease is more of a syndrome. It tells you about the symptoms that we see with this condition, and it could have different underlying causes. So it goes back to my initial conversation that with neurological disease, sometimes you see the symptoms, but the symptoms could be from different types of disease processes if they're affecting that location of the brain or spinal cord. And our job is to, based on our exam, pinpoint where the problem is coming from. And then with the additional diagnostics that we can offer, find out what the underlying cause is in order to get the best treatment and the best outcome available.
I know one of the most frustrating aspects when pets present to me with these various clinical signs is trying to, especially if it's an early on, boy, you know, is this a pet that maybe has a brain tumor? Does it have a stroke? If it's something like a vestibular issue, does it have an earache? So what are some of the signs people should look for at home when they say, I've been seeing this now for a little bit. Is the pet just off, or do I need to see a veterinarian?
And that's a very good question, and actually is something that both, you know, my clients, the pet owners, the veterinarians, we always, you know, deal with, and always a question. And some of these conditions, they happen when the pet becomes, you know, older. So that's always a question that I get from my clients too. Initially, you know, they're not sure, is this just a normal aging process? You know, the pet is doing this because he or she is getting older, or is this a disease process? So I would say, first things first, if there is anything abnormal, at least this is my philosophy, I would rather get a false alarm than miss something important. So for my existing clients, I always tell them, give me a call, leave me a message at least. Let me know, hey, Fluffy is having these signs, and then, you know, I can tell them that whether it's something to be worried about or not. So I assume, you know, a lot of times, you know, their primary veterinarian would be the best first person to contact. But sometimes these cases could be so vague that even for a veterinarian, it's hard to say, okay, is this something significant or not? And what I would recommend for most of my clients to do is, first thing, if a pet is doing anything that looks or appears abnormal, especially these days with, you know, almost everyone having a smartphone and cameras and video cameras being widely available, videotape it. You know, it's always sometimes, you know, looking at 30 seconds of a video is more informative than, you know, listening to a 5-minute description of an episode or an event going on at home.
Totally agree with you. They walk through the door, yeah, they tell you about it, but to see that picture, it's like, yes, now I understand exactly what you're trying to tell me.
Absolutely. And again, like some of us are better with, you know, more descriptive than others, but again, videos don't lie, and oftentimes, you know, they could be very informative. So I always kind of, when I have cases that the symptoms sound really vague based on, you know, and some of these things could be episodic, so by the time the pet comes to our hospital, they're normal at that time, I always encourage them to videotape them, send them to me, and then based on the nature of those episodes for me to make, you know, further recommendations, you know, to them. The other thing is, if they see any trends with, you know, the episode that's happening. You know, is it something that happens with activity? Does it happen during rest? Is there anything like eating that could trigger it to happen? Because all these things could be meaningful to the doctor and to try to figure out what type of problem we or the pet may be dealing with.
One of probably the most common neurological issues that I see are seizures. And people see this at home, especially if it's the typical, what they think of the typical grand mal, falling over, paddling, pooping, sometimes crying out. It seems to last for, you know, half an hour, and maybe it's just a matter of moments. You were mentioning that seizures are just a burst of spontaneous electrical activity in the brain. I'd really love to have you kind of discuss seizures as to possible causes. Do they always need to be treated? What are seizures? What can people do?
Yeah, so seizures are could be one of the most challenging, you know, conditions that we deal with, both medically and emotionally, because, you know, having a pet with seizures is very difficult for, you know, the members of the household too, and it could, you know, be devastating to, you know, the pet owners, the kids in the family or so. So with seizures, as you mentioned, is just kind of an abnormal burst of spontaneous electrical activity in the brain. And, you know, all of us, you know, have what's called a seizure threshold, you know, and as long as our activity and the threshold are in balance with each other, we don't have seizures. But if for any type of condition, our seizure threshold goes down, then we will be prone to having seizures. As mentioned, seizures are just, you know, manifestation of a problem or just a symptom, and the underlying cause, there are many, many different causes for it. But just to put them in two big group of diseases that would be practical for, you know, pet owners to understand is seizures either could have an underlying cause, and that underlying cause could be many different things, you know, from brain disease to diseases out of the brain, which in a couple of minutes we're going to, you know, mention some of the more common ones, or be what's called an idiopathic epilepsy. Idiopathic epilepsy means, you know, a seizure of unknown origin, which is genetic in origin, you know, so there is no structural abnormality with the brain. What it is, it's an abnormal chemical activity or electrical activity of the brain. And with idiopathic epilepsy, what happens is you don't have an underlying disease to treat. So if the pet needs treatment, it's going to be symptomatic treatment of the seizures with anti-epileptic medications, which fortunately in this day and age, we have many different options. So we definitely try to establish a treatment plan that is appropriate for that dog based on the nature of the seizures and what other conditions is going on with the dog. You know, we at the end of the day, we have to take everything into consideration. How is the dog's blood work, kidney values, liver values, and so forth. The other, you know, conditions are when there is an underlying reason for the seizures, and when we divide them, we call them either intracranial, meaning diseases that are happening in the brain. And those are the ones that, you know, are more, you know, straightforward. People at least understand better. You know, unfortunately, with older pets, we see brain tumors. You know, we see strokes, as we discussed at the start of this conversation. Encephalitis or meningitis, just a term for inflammation or infection of the brain, and many more conditions. So those are the conditions that directly affect the brain, and as a consequence of that, the pet could have seizures or other neurological conditions. But the other thing is extracranial causes. Those are diseases out of the brain that they affect the brain and, you know, they could cause seizures. One of the more common things would be what's called a portosystemic shunt, for example. Like in small breed or toy breed dogs, especially younger ones, sometimes they could have an abnormal vessel that bypasses the liver. And as we know, liver, you know, has a job of filtering a lot of the byproducts in the brain. So if some of the abnormal byproducts, which are toxic to the brain, do not get filtered and end up in the bloodstream, they could affect the brain and cause seizures, for example. It's called hepatic encephalopathy, meaning seizure that comes from or brain disease that comes from a liver problem. So that's one of the things we see. Low blood sugar, you know, regardless of the cause, that could be another reason for seizures, and many more that could be the extracranial or the diseases out of the brain that cause the seizures. So when we address a seizure case, we kind of do a comprehensive, you know, workup. First, we do a neurological exam on a dog and see, based on the examination, do we see any hint of any abnormalities with their brain? And if we see some abnormal neurological findings, that's oftentimes indication that there might be a primary brain disease. Then the patient will need a full blood work done, you know, CBC chemistry and sometimes additional tests like thyroid panel or, you know, test of liver function. Oftentimes, this is done by the primary veterinarian. You know, the family veterinarian first does the blood work, and then if the blood work is, you know, normal, they get referred to us for further case, and sometimes it's done by us. And then if everything is, you know, unremarkable and doesn't explain the seizures, the next step is to look for primary brain issues. And that's when the MRI to look for, you know, structural brain abnormalities, or a spinal tap, which looks for evidence of encephalitis or meningitis, is done. And the combination of these tests in most cases allow us to either identify the underlying reason for the seizure and treat it to the best of our ability, which many of these conditions are quite treatable or manageable. Or if we rule everything else out and everything is normal, that's, you know, how we can objectively diagnose idiopathic epilepsy. You know, idiopathic epilepsy, for the most part, is a diagnosis of exclusion when we exclude all the other findings out.
And Dr. Gorich, I know that people are oftentimes most concerned about their pets being in pain. And I've always said that seizures, we can honestly say, are not painful unless they fall down, hurt themselves, etc. Because we can talk to people who have seizures and say, is the seizure process itself painful? And my response to people has always been, seizures are not painful. Am I correct in that?
Yes, you are. So seizures oftentimes are not painful. I would say they're probably more difficult for the people in the household to see it, and it could be quite devastating based on how people with seizures or people with epilepsy, they feel. You know, definitely they could be a phase before the seizure that the patient or the pet could feel abnormal and, for lack of a better term, could feel a little bit awkward or spacey, but the actual seizure episode is not painful for the pet.
Great. I've been speaking right now with Dr. Ali Gorji. He is a board-certified veterinary neurologist and neurosurgeon and owner of Bright Care Veterinary Hospital in Orange County, California. We'll be right back after the short break to talk about more things going on with our pet's neurological system.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Put on a perfectly possum pet party. Having an awesome birthday or adoption day celebration for your four-legged friend? Or just want a fun excuse to throw a fun party with your friends from the dog park? Deck out your party with Molly and Bandit Pet Party Accessories. Party products designed specifically for pets. There are wearables, including adjustable pet party hats, bow ties, and tutus. The photo prop kits include funny glasses and hats. The party supplies and decorations include coordinating table covers, party banners, cake decorations, and treat bowls, cups, and bags. Everything you need to create great memories and Instagram-worthy photos. They're available in two colorful themes, Tropical and Fireman. It's a dog's life. Celebrate it with Molly and Bandit Pet Party at mollyandbanditpetparty.com/petlife.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Gorji, this has just been an awesome way of breaking down the various clinical signs that people are seeing. Paralysis, weakness, pain, seizures, vestibular system. Vestibular, I'd really like to have you address that, because I think that can be one of the most disconcerting. You wake up in the morning, your pet seems fine, and now it has a head tilt. Its eyes many times are doing these funky things of zipping back and forth quickly in their head. It's just like, oh my goodness, it must have had a stroke. They come rushing in, and too often we have to say, it's idiopathic, my favorite term in veterinary medicine, because I can't give them a reason. Please chat a little bit about the vestibular system.
Absolutely. And before I kind of talk about the vestibular system, I just want to add a little other comment to complete our talk about seizures.
Oh, please.
I just want to kind of, as a pet owner, is If you have a pet that is either under 1 year of age or over 6 years of age, and at that age starts having seizures, the likelihood of having an underlying cause dramatically goes up. Basically, most dogs with idiopathic epilepsy, they are between 1 and 6 years of age. So if you have a pet that, you know, falls out of these group, it becomes even more important to further investigate. You know, I see cases that like an 8-year-old dog, 9-year-old dog, all of a sudden having seizures. Those cases usually would require to see a neurologist and further investigate, because the vast majority of them, they have an underlying reason for it. And I just want to kind of mention that so the pet owners are aware of that.
Thank you.
But as far as vestibular disease, you're welcome. So vestibular disease, as you mentioned, oftentimes it comes out of nowhere. It could, you know, the client goes to work, comes back home, finds their pet, or sometimes, as you mentioned, they wake up in the morning and find their pet, and they are quite disoriented, difficulty walking, they having severe vertigo type of events, head tilt, abnormal eye movement, which is called nystagmus when the eyes are moving fast. And the symptoms, again, both for the dog and for the, you know, pet parents, they could be quite devastating. Vestibular disease, again, like seizures, it's just a syndrome. So when we say a dog has vestibular disease, we're saying based on the symptoms, it has a vestibular signs, and they could have different underlying causes for it. One of the causes is, as you mentioned, what's called an idiopathic or so-called old dog vestibular disease. And that's whenever we use the term idiopathic, it means there is no obvious underlying cause for it. Keep in mind, in dogs, idiopathic vestibular disease happens in older dogs, or it's much more likely to happen in older dogs. So if you have a 3-year-old dog, 4-year-old dog that have vestibular signs, it's highly unlikely to be idiopathic. There's all, you know, usually underlying cause for it. But if you have a dog above, you know, 8-9 years of age, then idiopathic becomes one of the possibilities for the symptoms. But the other causes would be basically, when we talk about vestibular disease, we put them in three categories. One would be idiopathic disease. The other one would be what's called a central vestibular disease, meaning the vestibular disease is coming from the problem in the brain, and to be more specific, in the back part of the brain, which is called the brainstem or cerebellum. And those are the cases that they could present very similar, at least to the pet owner, they could look very, very similar. And that it could be from a stroke in that part of the brain. It could be from a brain tumor. It could be from an encephalitis, which, as we discussed, is inflammation or infection of the brain, cystic structures in that part of the brain, and so forth. So that would be another reason for it. And another fairly common reason that we see vestibular disease is what's called a peripheral vestibular disease. And that comes from middle ear problems, because as we know, the middle ear is also responsible for maintaining balance. And if we have an abnormality in that part of the ear, you know, the most common that we clinically see is called otitis media, which is infection of the middle ear. That could also cause, you know, the patient to have vestibular signs. And that's the more common cause. You know, less commonly, dogs could get neoplastic processes or tumors in the middle ear. And, you know, sometimes there could be polyps in the middle ear. All those things could also cause, you know, vestibular signs to happen. So it's important when a pet is having vestibular signs, based on the dog's age or the pet's age, breed, and also exam findings, prior history, to be able to better determine what the underlying cause is. As a veterinary neurologist, when I examine these cases, my goal is to try to find out, is it central or not? So basically, do I see any indication on my exam to say this is coming from the brain or not? If we see that, then we have a, you know, obvious understanding that's coming from the brain, and then we look at to find out the underlying cause for it. If we don't see any obvious evidence of the disease coming from the brain, still we cannot exclude it from coming from the brain, but at least we can kind of talk about the different scenarios or different possibilities going on. And I'm going to open up a small small bracket over here, as we discussed the difference between different species, one big difference between dogs and cats, if you remember early on I said, dogs get idiopathic vascular disease when they're older in life. In cat, it could happen anytime in life. So that's one difference. The second thing is oftentimes when dogs have middle ear infection, it's an, you know, external ear disease. So dogs that get, you know, otitis externa, which is external ear infection, that over time it progresses into becoming a middle ear infection. And cats, they could get a, and they often do get a middle ear infection without having an external ear sign. So those are just some of the differences that we see between dogs and cats.
I know one of the issues that I've seen between dogs and cats, there have been times, you know, we clean dogs' ears all the time. They get ear infections, they get material in their ears, and they shake their head afterwards and they're fine. But there have been times I've cleaned a cat's ears and all of a sudden I finish and they end up with a head tilt and the stagmus, the eyes darting one way to the other very quickly. And it's like, oh my goodness, now I need to explain to the client that it was a idiopathic reaction to ear cleaning and give it some time and it will resolve. But it's very disconcerting for all parties involved.
Absolutely. And that's another thing that happens much more, you know, or could happen much more often with cats that even with a, you know, ear cleaning. But as you mentioned, the good news about that is it's oftentimes self-limiting and giving the cat some time to heal from it, the symptoms become quite, you know, better with time.
And the old dog vestibulopathy with the others, you know, there's so many different underlying issues that can be associated. But with the old dog vestibulopathy, medications many times are just symptomatic. I try to tell my clients it's like the worst case of seasickness that you've ever had. It's like, oh, the world is just spinning. And the dog many times just wants to lay against the wall and just not move. And sometimes they're left with a permanent little bit of a head tilt and looking rather coquettish.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I explain. I always say this dog is having a massive motion sickness. It's probably the worst motion sickness that you've seen. And treatment, because there's no obvious underlying cause, you know, there's no definitive treatment for it, but the management and treatment of the case is on supportive care and trying to minimize the symptoms. You know, a lot of times they are very disoriented, you know, for lack of a better term, the entire world is spinning around their head. And sometimes it's they even, you know, they're so, they have such a severe motion sickness that the client, you know, initially they see vomiting. And so the treatment is to decrease the motion sickness, which we give them anti-motion sickness medication, sometimes sedatives to help them out. And we treat the symptoms. The idiopathic vestibular disease is self-limiting. Usually in a matter of a few days, they feel a lot better. As you mentioned, the head tilt is oftentimes one of the later things to go away. And in a small group of cases, they could always have a small residual head tilt that does not 100% go back to normal, but oftentimes it gets a lot better. So if there's ever a case that has a tentative diagnosis of idiopathic vestibular disease, but after a few days, the, you know, pet owner or the vet sees that the pet is not getting better, the symptoms are continuing to happen or getting worse, or they see a lot of waxing and waning of the signs, that should always be a red flag that maybe this pet is not suffering from idiopathic vestibular disease and there might be another underlying disease that, you know, warrants further care.
Dr. Gorgi, we're talking about older dogs having this vestibular issue. I know one of the things I see a lot with older dogs in particular, people come in saying, I think my dog has gone deaf. And it's just not hearing, or it seems to have very specific ranges in which it can hear. It's kind of like I always say, it's having, you know, a married couple, they've known each other for 40 years, and he just can't seem to hear his wife's voice, but boy can hear the refrigerator open and getting dinner out and getting it prepared. Dogs do often have deafness issues. What are some of the causes? What are some of the treatments that are possible?
Yeah, that's actually another fairly common question that I do get, since in veterinary medicine, we don't have really an, you know, audiologist. So one of the, you know, basically for deafness, usually they present to a neurologist. And in veterinary medicine, obviously, because of our patients and the way you can do, there is no hearing test the way we know it in people. Basically, there is no test to be able to objectively evaluate their hearing and say, for example, this pet has 30% hearing in this ear and this percentage hearing in that ear. So there's no test clinically to do. There is a hearing test called, you know, BAER, but that test is not really helpful for a patient that is showing decreased hearing because it's an all or none test. The test itself just says if the dog has any hearing or the dog doesn't have any hearing and in which ear it is. So usually the test is reserved for, you know, litter of puppies, you know, especially breeds like Dalmatians or so, which is important to see if they have congenital deafness or patients that, you know, the client is not sure, are they completely deaf or are they deaf in one ear? Again, that test we do, it's, you know, since our patients cannot respond to us, we have to look at how the brainstem kind of gets affected by the testing of the hearing. So it's called like BAER, which stands for brainstem auditory evoked response. It's a test that we do, but in many cases of older dogs that are hard of hearing, this test is not helpful. And although the clients come here to do it, I usually kind of discuss it that it's really not going to help with the clinical outcome or treatment of the pet. But hearing loss, to put it in two big group of conditions, it's either coming from damage to the nerve or the nerves in the inner ear, which is called sensorineural hearing loss or deafness, or the other group is called conductive deafness. That's the deafness that comes from something affecting the conduction of the sound in the ear. One example is if the dog has severe otitis media, the dog has a lot of fluid behind the eardrum, or if the dog has some sort of pathology with the eardrums, that could also cause, you know, deafness or decreased hearing. As a general rule, if the deafness is from nerve issues, whether it's the congenital condition in some breeds, which is an old age change, which dogs exactly like us, sometimes when they get older, they could have decreased hearing. In this day and age, there is no practical or common treatment or hearing aids for pets. On the other hand, if it's a conductive type of deafness, meaning there is, you know, middle ear infection, there is a lot of fluid in the ear, there is a polyp in some cases, those cases, sometimes when you treat the underlying condition and they either get treated medically or they get a procedure called meningotomy, when you drain the fluid behind the eardrum, get a sample of it, and the dog receives treatment, sometimes the hearing becomes improved after that. So for the conductive deafness, sometimes there's a treatment. But the important thing is to evaluate these dogs, you know, or these pets. Also, it's going to be getting a very thorough history, getting a very good evaluation, and based on that, make further recommendations, whether there is something we can do to further identify the hearing loss, or whether it sounds like just a, you know, degenerative old age change. But again, in those cases, not much you can do. As you mentioned, some of these pets, I see them quite often, they are quite selective about hearing. You know, when mom or dad calls them to come to them, they ignore them, but they could hear the, you know, bag of potato chips from second floor quite well and just run to the, you know, kitchen for that. So sometimes, you know, as they get older, they become more selective in what they want or they do not want to hear.
Dr. Gorgi, there is so much more I do want to hear about paralysis and weakness and disc disease, and knowing that you're a neurosurgeon, and just because a pet does have disc disease doesn't mean it's a death sentence and there's nothing that can be done. But we are at our 30 minutes. This was just very interesting. I do appreciate your time today and appreciate all of our listeners tuning in to hear about ways that they can be the best possible pet owner. Anything that you just want to wrap this up with very quickly, Dr. Gorgi?
No, I thank you for the opportunity. And as you, I agree with you that actually some of the most rewarding cases, just too quickly, are the, you know, acute paralysis or, you know, paralysis cases that they come. A lot of times the clients feel there's no hope, but many, many of these cases are treatable. And with surgery, I have, you know, we have many patients that years later, they stop by with their pets and the pet still is doing doing great. So just because the dog or the cat, for that matter, goes paralyzed doesn't mean there's no hope for it. Sometimes time is of essence. So many of these cases, just as a pet owner, we have to act fast because sometimes few days makes a difference between a good outcome and a poor outcome. That's the last thing I just wanted to mention to our listeners so they recognize that.
Perfect. And I totally agree with you. If you have a doubt, if you have a concern, don't deny that it's there. Bring it to your veterinarian's attention when possible. Take that video of it. Take pictures of it. It's so, so helpful. So don't put it off. See your veterinarian. This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz. You've been listening to Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. Thank you so much for listening. Please tune in again next week. We'll have more information on how to make you that best possible pet owner. Take care.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.